Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 27, Episode 23. Coming up on this show, we've got tips on surviving a deglobalized future, how the Zoomers can save civilization, and learning the secret formula of doppelganger generation. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
I don't know if that's a world I want to live in.
One of those things is not like the others.
That would be the last thing. That is very different to the others.
Something light, I hope, the secret formula of doppelganger.
Well, yes, creation. We are. Yeah, for our Plus extension, because I know you've got something that's rather, should I say, dark coming up for this part of the show. But towards the end of the show in our Plus extension, I'm going to go into some research that was conducted by Brad Steiger back in the 70s and the 80s relating to the phenomena of astral projection in its all forms. You know, we're just talking about crisis apparitions, doppelgangers, vartigas, telepathy, crisis, you know, all that stuff. Like I say, crisis
twice. Vartigas.
All that kind of stuff, right? But I came across this incredible encounter where he regressed this woman and she had this sudden past life experience, which is kind of cool in itself. Like the past life experience is fascinating. But there was some type of intrusion by some other, let's just say, paranormal phenomena that makes this just one of the most incredible stories that I've ever read.
Astral spiders?
No, well, no, it's not actual astral spiders, but the fear level is probably the equivalent of that. So we're going to go into that at the end of the show, but what have you got coming up, Ben?
I picked up the new Peter Zeihan book.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, it's, listen to the headline. The end of the world is just the beginning, mapping the collapse of globalization. This guy's, he's been called the geopolitical Nostradamus.
Really? Yeah, yeah, right. I mean, I've seen some of his stuff, and as I said, it tends to be dark. Like it's, you would think that the collapse of globalization is a good thing, but if it happens rapidly, we're all in a lot of trouble.
The guy knows what he's talking about. He's worked for the US State Department. I think he was actually stationed in Australia at one point.
Oh, right.
He's worked for multiple think tanks in the US. He's been helping develop analytical models for Stratfor, mm-hmm. you know, the big private intelligence company, Stratfor. He's also lectured at Langley a bunch of times. So
he knows his stuff.
He knows his stuff. He's a fantastic historian, an incredible researcher. It's a history book as well because he takes you through. It was really like the game Civilization for me.
Oh, really?
You know the game Civilization? Yeah. Like you start off, you pick a section of land on the map. You got to make sure you're near a water source and there's some
and
food
wood.
Nearby. And then gradually through the stages of the game, you build up slowly until you go through the stages of civilization. Well, in his opening parts of this book, it's really like going through civilization. He maps out how we got to where we are today in a really succinct, entertaining way. And then just, oh my gosh, delivers a scud missile of doom to everything that's been built in the last few thousand years.
It really is a heavy dose of doom porn. And the issue is that I think over the past couple of years, Ben, particularly with COVID, you know, this has become a topic that people are starting to pay attention to because of lockdowns. We're having supply shortages. We're starting to see the ramifications of that because initially it wasn't a major problem.
That's the reason I wanted to talk about this today, because I think many of you listening at home, you will have noticed the same thing.
Everywhere.
If you notice that it's hard to get stuff now, that things are in short supply, that it takes a long time to order anything. And it can be ranging from fertilizer to cement to a special piece of electronics you need for your car. Like anything you can think of is hard to get
mm-hmm.
and in short supply. And there's rampant inflation as well. There's major economic problems across the world.
Yeah, and global inflation.
And it's at a global scale. And yep. There's this feeling of, what are we on the precipice of?
Mm.
What's coming next? And Peter tries to answer that question. And some of you will like the answer for various geographical reasons, but most of us will not like the answer. So he claims, we've been living in a kind of mini golden age. I'll read you a little bit from his introduction. He says, the past century or so has been a bit of a blitzkrieg of progress. We went from horse and buggy to passenger trains and to the family car to everyday air travel. From the abacus to adding machines to desktop calculators to smartphones. We went from iron to stainless steel to silicon-laced aluminium touch-sensitive glass. From waiting for wheat to being handed chocolate on demand.
Mm-hmm.
our world has gotten cheaper, faster, he says. And during the past 7 decades, as a percent of the population, fewer people have died in fewer wars and fewer occupations and fewer famines and fewer disease outbreaks than since the dawn of recorded history. Historically speaking, he says, we live in an embarrassment of riches and peace. All these evolutions and more are tightly interwoven. But he says there's a simple fact that is often overlooked. They are artificial. We have been living in a perfect moment, he says. This is what I'm saying. It's like a mini golden age. And it's passing. He says the world of the past few decades has been the best it will ever be in our lifetime. Instead of cheap and better and faster, we're rapidly transitioning into a world that's pricier and worse and slower because our world is breaking apart. Now remember, this is the guy that lectures the CIA on this stuff. And he can see it clear. The writing is on the wall. And again, I feel like the everyday Joe is now starting to notice it as well.
Yeah.
Because it's becoming intruding in our everyday life.
Ben, lettuce is $12 here.
Is it really?
Like, that's just insane. Like, well, I don't know that there's other factors, like there's been flooding going on, but you've got lettuce that's $12. You've got other fruit and veg that are not available, so supermarket shelves are bare. But you're seeing this in the US as well. You're seeing Walmart. You know, huge aisles are empty.
Yeah. We've been doing okay. So I went to look at a new car the other day. I like the juxtaposition there. I went to look at a new car, and the waiting list on any car
is about
over 12 months,
yep.
Like 12 to 18 months. Everyone says the same, supply chain issues. One model I was looking at, they couldn't complete the model because like they couldn't get them off the shipping line. They couldn't produce them because of the chip shortage, because they need the chip to run certain aspects of the car, like the overhead camera and all this other stuff.
What was the other thing that was missing from it? It was the blind spot monitors. They didn't have a chip to control the blind spot monitors. So they had to from a modern car.
It wasn't the salesman also saying that some models, you can't even get central locking because they don't have
the chip for
the keys.
Yeah. So you're waiting 12 to 18 months for a car in Australia, depending on the brands you go for, and it doesn't have central. Could you imagine a world, Ben, where we have to go back to no central locking?
Well, we
were leaning over to undo the car of the 80s?
Well, will they have to start making cars that have less electronics?
Well, they will.
And this is an example of the already devolution of technology in society, where things have to get simpler because of all these issues. And again, I know that you listening have noticed it, where you have to wait longer for things. Everything's kind of on the brink of falling apart. So this golden age that he's describing there, it began after World War II. He says, since 1945, the world has been the best it has ever been, the best it will ever be, he says. It's a poetic way of saying this era, our world, is doomed. The 2020s will see a collapse of consumption and production and investment and trade almost everywhere. Globalization will shatter into pieces, some regional, some national, some smaller. It'll be costly. It'll make life slower and above all, worse. Now, he starts going through what got us here to this golden age. And like I said, it's like civilization taking us through the very start. He takes us back to the very beginning of civilization in this cycle that we know of.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he doesn't use those words, but I always like to couch it in this idea of this cycle that we know of. He goes back to us being wanderers, you know, hunters and gatherers wandering
nomadic around.
Yeah, and we went where we went because we were bloody hungry.
Yeah.
We wandered with the seasons. We went up and down elevation bands to forage. We followed animals because he says that's where the stakes were. That's what we wanted.
Well, animals are migratory as well.
Exactly. He said typically we wouldn't stay in the same place for more than a few weeks because we'd forage and hunt until there was really nothing left and then we'd have to move on. Our stomachs would force us to start wandering. Starvation and disease were common. Any rabbit you ate was a rabbit that someone else didn't get to eat. So, yeah, we lived in harmony with nature, he says. But that's just another way of saying...
a really uncomfortable way to live.
Like when we saw our neighbours, we would try and kill them and they'd try and kill us. And whoever lost would be eaten by the winner. That is pretty much the reality. So he says, then one miraculous day, something happened, something new and wondrous made life different. It made life less violent, less precarious. Our world was changed. And that thing was that we started gardening in our poo.
Fertilizer.
Changed everything.
Yep.
Human poo, he says.
Agriculture.
Proved to be one of the best fertilizer and growth mediums, not just in the pre-civilized world, but right up until the mass introduction of chemical fertilizers. So we were still using it like 100 years ago in some places, or 50 years ago.
They still use it in some places in Asia.
Yeah. The great poo breakthrough also introduced to humans the first rule of geopolitics, and that's location matters. So he goes through the area you need to take advantage of this new poo technology. So you need a large chunk of flat land to farm. You need climate that will let you grow almost all year round. You need a consistent water flow to, you know, irrigate and everything. And you need a place that has natural defenses too, because if you decide to farm, that doesn't mean your neighbors are going to decide to farm as well. They might decide to come and forage your farm that you've worked on. And just help themselves. So we needed a different geography of success versus the wandering and gathering geography we had before. So he starts talking about the areas where, well, there's really only a couple of places on Earth where you could take advantage of specific criteria to farm back then.
Is this basically equatorial areas?
Well, yeah, you're close. You needed rivers that flow through low latitude, low altitude, or low altitude deserts.
Mm-hmm.
So you need the river for the water. But low latitude regions get long sun-filled days, so you can grow more of the season, which means less hunger. If you have a low altitude river, when it runs through flat zones, it leaves behind this nutrient-rich sediment, which is good. It's a good poo enhancer.
Yep.
Enhances your poo technology. And then if you're in a desert region, it keeps the neighbors at bay because no one's really foraging through a desert. But if you've got a river there, you're okay. So there's other advantages to rivers. And he goes through all the stuff you'd need, like transport. It takes 12 times more energy to move things on land versus water. So if you've got rivers, you've got a river system, really easy to move stuff around.
Is this why the ancient Egyptians were so successful?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. The other big advantage is digestion. So I was like, what? Digestion? Well, he explains it. You can start farming, but obviously you can't just eat wheat directly. You can't just eat raw corn. You've got to grind it up. You've got to process it. You've got to turn it into flour to make bread, to make porridge, to make stuff that you can digest. And to do that, you need energy. So the energy we had before was all muscle power.
Yeah, labor.
Whether it's muscle power from you yourself, from human beings, or whether it's from
oxen,
animals, right? Rivers solve this problem when water wheels were invented.
Because
you've got constant power. The wheel drives a bunch of stones that grind together. You just throw in your agriculture. You just throw in your wheat or whatever, and it grinds it up. And as long as the water's flowing, you've got, boom, flour. And with this process, something happened. All this growing became less labor intensive. He said, we started generating food surpluses for the first time in history. This freed up a bit of labor. People suddenly had free time. Now they could come up with something to do, which was manage the food surpluses. So bam, now you've got pottery to store the food. You've got numbers to figure out inventory and all that stuff.
So you're essentially creating industry.
Now you need some way to store the urns and keep track of the math, and bam, now you've got basic engineering and basic writing. Now you need a way to distribute the stored food. Bam, you've got roads. All our stuff, he says, needed to be kept, managed, and guarded in a centralized location, while all our skills needed to be passed on to future generations. And then bam, you've got urbanization, you've got education. So it's amazing how he traces this back to a river.
Yeah, but it makes sense.
With a water wheel in it. It just, it creates all this stuff. I mean, it takes a long time, but that's the inception point of it. At each stage, we pulled a bit of labor out of agriculture, he said, and into new industries. And then these steadily increasing levels of labor specialization and urbanization gave us towns, then city states, then we have kingdoms, eventually empires. Sedentary agriculture may have given us more calories, while deserts provided better security, but it took the power of rivers to put us on the road to civilization. So again, I was just imagining like a game of civilization where bling, your thing pops up and then you build another thing.
Somebody get an upgrade notification.
Yeah. So you have all these little river-driven agricultural systems popping up all over the world. But they wouldn't really last because there was all this pressure from other cultures. Like even the Romans, who were the most badass of them all, they were eventually wiped out after, what, 5 centuries? So the real kicker in that next technological change, it didn't make humans more durable. It made them less durable because there was so much competition. So the next cultural tech breakthrough is in the 7th century, and it's windmills, wind power.
Oh.
So they develop sails, and obviously you've got a windmill that can drive the thing that takes care of the wheat and the corn and everything else and grinds it into something you can eat. Now, this means you no longer have to be near a river. You can do your agriculture anywhere where the wind's blowing.
But you need a hill, I take it.
I don't know if you need it. Why do you need a hill?
Well, the thing was, I was recently looking into the history of Brisbane, and there's a windmill that was established for convicts, and they put it on this hill, but even though it was on the hill, they never got enough wind. So they had to get the convicts in to actually move the windmill.
So back to muscle grain. Power.
Yes, back to muscle power.
Yeah, so obviously people try and fail, like many places tried and failed. But this means you have all these little cultures that can now pop up everywhere, okay? But it becomes so common and far less secure because everyone's butting into each other all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates conflict and war.
And friction.
So war involves players with better food supplies, more technology, meaning that war didn't simply become more common, he said. It became more destructive. So for the first time, the existence of a human population was linked to specific pieces of infrastructure. So for example, if you wanted to destroy your enemy, you just destroy their windmills.
Yeah,
and they start,
smart.
They're dead. And then wind power led to this technical explosion. So he starts talking about these wind-dependent cultures because there were so many more of them, the absolute supply of skilled labor that humans could generate exploded. So the first phase of that agriculture with poo technology, that kicked in around 11,000 BCE. And then you have 3 millennia go by before we figure out how to jump to water milling. That was in the last couple of centuries BCE. And then the grinding of the windmill wasn't common until the 7th and 8th century CE. So it took a long time.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to compress it when you're talking about it, but it's a long time.
It's thousands of years. What's going on? And it's funny how that lines up with everything we've researched on the fall of the last great civilization,
yes,
with Atlantis being destroyed and everything else. The timing is very specific to that point where human beings have nothing, and then all of a sudden someone's like, well, why don't we use some poo and grow something? So this is now a point where history speeds up because you've got tens of thousands of these proto-engineers constantly tinkering with dozens of windmill designs for all these populated areas. And this has all these spin-off effects. So air dynamics is better understood. So eventually we start making sailing vessels with single masts, and then we develop those. And then this leads to multi-masted vessels with specialized sail shapes for different like conditions. And then this sparks innovation with ship construction methods to navigation techniques to weaponization. And in a mere 8 centuries, humanity's experience on the sea transformed utterly. The quantity of cargo that a single vessel could ship increased from a few hundred pounds to a few hundred tons. Now, multi-month transoceanic and circumcontinental voyages were possible. So what happens now? Political entities can leverage these new technologies. They can generate massive inflows of income, which are then used to fortify defenses, educate their populations, and pay for expanded civil services and military forces. And the advances sail on. Eventually, you have deep water navigation. Because previously, before deep water navigation, you had this food restriction, right? So a single trader couldn't make a really long distance trip because, you know, you'd run out of food. So instead, long distance trade was along like hundreds routes. Of middlemen routes.
Yeah, right. Pull into a port.
Like the Silk Road, for example, it's not like you start in China and you go all the way to the West.
You go to an outpost.
You go to an outpost, you trade there, they go to the next one, trade there, and it just, there's all these little steps in the chain. And what that results in at the end is a, like a 10,000% markup of the silk or whatever you're buying.
Yeah.
Like whatever weird Chinese thing you're buying a thousand years ago.
Also at the same time, it creates this roaring trade along that route.
Yeah, but again, a massive markup and you can't carry much because you need to carry food for the long trip as well. Deep water navigation just completely solved this problem.
So what's deep water navigation?
Having a ship big enough that you can just sail off into the ocean.
Okay, like, right.
You know, across an ocean, basically. These new ships could just sail for, obviously, for months at a time. They had massive holds, so they didn't need to stop for supplies as much. They had arsenals as well, so no one was trying to rob them along the way. They had cannons and everything. And they had a lack of middlemen. So the cost of these luxury goods that would be traded from faraway places, it just drops 90%. Like suddenly things are incredibly cheaper. Now, the powers that had these deep water ships, they start controlling all the ports along the sailing routes so their cargo ships and military vessels can resupply along the way.
So would this be the British and the Spanish?
British, Spanish, Portuguese.
Yeah.
The reason their profits surge is because they don't have to carry as much food in the hold of their ship. They've now got all this extra room for the goods that they then sell.
Mm-hmm.
So again, profits are up massively. And then they can afford to get more people with guns and more defenses. And it's just this snowball effect of wealth and power. So this income empowers the more successful geographies even more. Now, what you want is these deep water ports in places that don't have massive land borders to protect because they're spending all their money on these ships and these shipping routes and everything. They don't have money to spend on armies. So what's the geographic area that's best going to take advantage of this? They have a natural border. They don't have to supply a massive army because they're not going to be threatened by a land invasion. The answer is England.
Yeah, island locations.
England comes in.
Yeah.
And they dominate the English Empire. So what you ultimately saw is this gap between those cultures who had these technologies and essentially they started to conquer lands that didn't have this technical acumen. So the world's dominant political unit rapidly evolved from sequestered agricultural communities to globe-spanning, trade-based, deep water empires. Now, this leads to more complexity. The empires need hubs to develop and process and craft and distribute everything. So you've got this demand for urbanization. You need labor specialization. The collapse in shipping costs opens up opportunities for lumber and textiles and sugar and tea and wheat to be sent off to imperial centers. So now you have all these other imperial outposts being set up. This gives rise to the world's first mega cities. Urban centers where no one is involved in agriculture at all. No one's bothered with the poo technology anymore.
No.
It's like you specialized in building the little things that runs this whole web of interconnectedness.
And in reality, that's still where we are today.
Yeah, exactly. That's the whole point of telling this story, because it's building up these thousands of years of foundations that led to what we have today. And then everyone's engaged in this value-added labor, so they're not doing, you know, the poo technology stuff. They're not growing stuff. So that accelerates technological advancement even more. So everything's accelerating faster and faster and faster. Less than two centuries into its deep water era, London becomes the world's largest, richest, and best-educated city in the world. And this massive concentration of wealth and technical skills in one place reaches critical mass. And the English generate sufficient new technologies to launch their own civilizational transformation. And this is stage two in civilization, the civilization game. I love in those games where if you play right, you're the first country to develop steamships and like gunpowder. And then you still come across the countries that have horses and bows and arrows and you just obliterate them.
Okay, yeah, I'm thinking, do you decimate them?
Oh, you just destroy them.
Yeah.
So here we have the Industrial Revolution. So we've gone thousands of years building upon this complexity to finally get to this Industrial Revolution where fossil fuels changes everything as we know.
Yeah.
Ships no longer need to sail around the world based on seasons. They've now got coal to generate steam, and you have this increasing strength and precision of energy. It redefines industries, metallurgy, construction, medicine, education, warfare, manufacturing, agriculture. Each generates its own technological suite based on the new energy, this cheap energy, which in turn transforms the life for human beings. Like, he gives some examples here. Advances in medicine didn't just improve health, they doubled lifespans. Concrete didn't just allow for real roads, it gave us high rises. The development of dyes didn't just spawn a chemicals industry, it directly led to fertilizers that increased agricultural output by a factor of four. Steel was now stronger, lighter, less brittle, and more corrosive resistant than iron. It provided every industry that used metal with a quantum leap in capacity. Anything that made muscle power less necessary helped build a coffin for slavery. This is an interesting thing. This is this new technology. Muscle power is now obsolete. You don't need slaves anymore. When this reverses, slavery is coming back.
Because I hadn't even thought of it that way.
We won't have, and I'm getting a bit ahead of myself here, we won't have what he's describing. We won't have these technologies. If we get reset, slavery is back in a big way because civilizations will want that muscle power again.
Yeah.
So
that's not good.
Moving on, similarly, electricity didn't just expand worker productivity. It generated light, which manufactured time. We've done whole shows on this with artificial light, meaning people had, like normally the sun goes down, you go to bed. Now you've got artificial light. Hey, I can read, I can
learn.
Well,
productivity is through the roof.
You know, I can do all this stuff now instead of just going to bed. And then there's no longer muscle, water, or wind power as the biggest restriction for this civilization now. It's now capital. This new era needs money, capital, to fund this. So to build everything, and everything's growing stronger and faster and everything's building and building and building, you need money, lots and lots of money. So this demands industrialized infrastructure that necessitates new methods of mobilizing capital. So we have capitalism come into form, you know, fully fledged as a system that everyone follows. And then you have the competing philosophies emerge as well. So trade becomes even more important. The deep water navigation made these empires global in reach. And you've got this industrial revolution. It takes about two generations of this industrial age where we get to the most horrific carnage in history with the two world wars, 100 million deaths. And
is he suggesting that that came about as a result of the Industrial Revolution, or it just facilitated it?
Well, it gave us everything we needed
to be able to
continue with human behavior.
Yes.
But just increase the carnage like 100-fold. He says, if anything, these world wars proved that geography still mattered. For while Britain and Germany and Japan and China and France and Russia, they were busy destroying each other and destroying each other's infrastructure, a relatively new people in a new geography not only were not a target of all this destruction, but they were instead using this war, World War II, to massively apply the technologies of water and wind and deep water and industrial capacity to their territory. And he says these new people, you might have heard of them, they're called Americans. So the next part of this is on the accidental superpower. So he's building, it's a great read because he's building up this foundation, and you really get a sense of the time scale involved, the complexity of everything, how each layer of civilization relies on the successful implementation of the previous layer and the hundreds or thousands of years sometimes of work that went into establishing that previous layer.
And all the intricate, you know, requirements as well.
Everything is relying on everything else. If one part fails, the whole thing fails. So let me run through some of the major points here without expanding on them, so we'll just breeze through it. But this is a huge book. I think it's over 500 pages from memory. But this is all about geography. So the United States is the most powerful river power and land power in known history.
Yep.
The United States is the most powerful deep water power in history. And the United States is the strongest and most stable industrial power in history. Now, this is where it gets interesting, and he sets the scene for really this golden age, this mini golden age that I described earlier. The Americans, these weird people, these weird new Americans, they were just hitting their stride when World War II broke out, right? And he says, after years of frenetic mobilization, they emerged as simply the most powerful expeditionary power in history, but also the only belligerent that at war's end occupied all the defeated powers. America came out on top, to put it really simply. And they were in control of key economic areas, population, logistic nodes on three continents, two ocean basins. That the Americans were basically in this perfect spot, this perfect position to build an empire. To really just say to these countries, all right, we're in control now. You respond to us. We're the boss.
Yeah.
We run things now. And that was their moment in history. Like, this was the moment for a new Rome to rise, Peter explains. But it didn't happen.
What do you mean it didn't happen?
It didn't happen. The Americans chose a different way to go. They offered their wartime allies a deal. The Americans would use their navy, the only navy of size to survive the war, to patrol the global ocean and protect everyone's commerce. Literally be world police. Mm-hmm. Like, I know
they are.
The South Park guys made a joke about America world police, but it's true. The Americans would open their market, which was the only market of size to actually survive the war. They would open it to allied exports so that all could export their way back to health. So America would just buy everyone else's stuff so that those other countries would get rich again. Americans would extend a strategic blanket overall so that no friend of America need ever fear invasion again. There was just one catch. You had to pick sides in the brewing Cold War.
Yes.
Now, of course, almost everyone chose to get rich and have peace.
And freedom.
And side with the Americans and have freedom. So instead of forging an empire global in scope and becoming the next Roman Empire, the Americans bribed up an alliance to contain the Soviet Union. And then you had the Bretton Woods deal, and Bretton Woods was basically the establishment of trade and monetary guidelines. It was where the American dollar, everything was pegged to the American dollar. The American dollar became the world's, you know, reserve currency.
But isn't it odd that since the Second World War, the American dollar has been steadily devaluing?
Well, it has a whole chapter on that, but I'm just trying to give you broad strokes,
right,
to line up everything else that's coming. So they offered peace and protection. This is what the Americans did. They transformed regional geopolitics by putting nearly all the warring empires of the previous age on the same team. Brilliant.
Smart.
So that the French aren't fighting the English anymore. They're on the same team. Like, you have all these, you know, the Portuguese aren't pissed off with the Spaniards and blah, blah, blah. Like, they still probably hate each other a little bit, but suddenly everyone's on the same team for the first time in history. It's pretty amazing. And it's a pretty good deal. And it worked really well. He says in a mere 40 years, the system succeeded in not just containing the Soviet Union, but choking it to death. And generated the longest and deepest period of economic growth and stability in known human history. Good times, he says. And we all, because we've all grown up with this system, we all think, that's totally normal. This is normal now.
Yep.
He says, it's not. This is the biggest mistake. We all think of it as normal, but he says it's the most distorted, twisted moment in human history. It makes it all incredibly fragile, because what's been created in the last 60 years is this abnormal abomination. Like, it's so different to everything else that's happened in thousands of years. There's no way we should think of it as normal, let alone take it for granted.
But did the same thing happen in Rome before it collapsed? Did it kind of go the same way?
No, Rome conquered. Rome went and conquered other regions, right? America said to the other regions, you do what you want. We'll trade together. You're totally independent. You've got your freedom. We're just all working together, right? We're just got to stop those evil communists. And everyone's like, great, sounds good.
Yeah,
let's do
good
it.
Deal.
All of a sudden, everyone has peace everywhere. You can trade and not worry about building up this ridiculous army because you're going to get invaded by your neighbor. It just creates this atmosphere for incredible wealth development and incredible growth in civilization.
But the way that he's speaking, it feels like the party's about to come to an end.
That's exactly right, Aaron. He says, it's now over. It's done. The Americans, seeing to the world's security concerns, enabled a truly globalized world to not only emerge but thrive. But there's nothing about it that was normal, he says. Globalization was always dependent upon the Americans' commitment to the global order, and that order hasn't served American strategic interests since the Soviets fell in 1989. Because that was the whole point of it. It was, we're in this war with the Soviets, America's got it, we've got to stop them. That was done.
So is it almost like we've lost a unifying enemy?
Yes. And that order was maintained because of America's need to keep that enemy at bay. Mm. And this is what he keeps referring it to as the American order or the order. And it's that order, that world order that we've had since the end of World War II. And he points out that it's basically like America holding up the world ceiling. Even if they continue to do it, there's nothing about the heyday of globalization that's sustainable, he says. There's nothing about this period that's sustainable. He says the days of 1980 to 2015, this incredible growth and prosperity, it's done.
Why though?
Okay, this is what I'm getting to. Why is it done? Good question. He says the collapse in birth rates that began across the developed world in the 1960s and across the developing world in the 1990s now has decades of steam behind it.
Elon Musk has been tweeting about this. I only saw recently that he basically said that we've sterilized ourselves.
He's pinned a demographic tweet with stats on his timeline now. That's the top tweet.
Yep.
And
I've
got a feeling other prominent people have been reading Peter's book. It's only new. I think it came out about a week ago, but I think it's starting to do the rounds and people are latching onto some of these statistics and going, oh, the math checks out.
Yeah. Look, I've been partially responsible for this in the past where I have indulged in this idea like we're overpopulated, like the planet's overpopulated. It's not true. I can't believe I fell for it. We are actually approaching population collapse. And now I can see from what you're talking about, Ben, that that will result in the collapse of our civilization.
The collapse of everything, yeah.
Everything.
So he talks about growth stories, right? There's this factor of every growth story that you'll find with industrialization. And it comes from a swelling population. This is what drives it. What most people miss, he says, is that there's another step in the industrialization, urbanization process. That's lower mortality increases the population to such a degree that it overwhelms any impact from a decline in birth rates, but only for a few decades.
Which is where we're at.
So those few decades have now passed. Eventually, gains in longevity max out, leaving a country a greater population, but with few children.
But an aging population that need healthcare and support.
And it snowballs. He says yesterday's few children leads to today's few young workers, leads to tomorrow's few mature workers. And now, at long last, he says, tomorrow has arrived. So he points out that in the 2020s, birth rates, they're not simply dropping. They've been so low for so long that even the countries with the younger age structures
doesn't matter.
And now running low on young adults. This is the demographic. Young adults, that's the demographic that makes children, that produces the children.
Yep.
They're low. As the already smaller 20-something and 30-something cadres age into their 30s and 40s, birth rates will not simply continue their long decline. They will completely collapse. And once a country has more older folks than children, the next horrible step is utterly unavoidable, a population crash. And because any country that begins this process is one that has already run out of young adults, these countries will never recover. It's not like it's this, oh, in the 1960s, you know, we ran out of birth rate, and then the birth rate was low, and then we came back. Doesn't come back.
But there's something else going on as well. I don't know what it is, and without becoming conspiratorial about it, it's always, you can see that it's not just that the birth rate is declining because people are choosing to have less children. It also seems like fertility rates are dropping rapidly.
Yeah, well, I did a show on that when you were on break.
Right,
and that was, women's fertility and men's fertility is dropping 1% per year like clockwork. Yeah.
So that's ironically, I think I was away for the birth of my second son.
Yeah, you were. that's why I did that show, because your kid was coming. But it's cultural as well. So people are less inclined to want children these days. Like the fall of any civilization, that's a cultural thing that emerges. And it's a factor of our environment and our biology as well, that our ability to have children is declining. And Peter points out that the faster you have growth on the front end, so the faster you have population and industrialization and urbanization at the start of your civilization, the faster it collapses on the other end.
Really? So there's kind of a pattern to this?
There is a pattern. And he says the most unfortunate tsunami of consequence of this compression phenomenon is happening in China. So like every other country and society before, China saw its population surge. So it went from under 800 million in 1970 to over 1.4 billion in 2021. But he says, look, if this is all just based on maths, this is just numbers. It's all demographic math. He says, no matter how you crunch the stats, China in 2022 is the fastest aging society in known human history. The population growth story is over there, and has been over since their birth rate slipped below replacement levels back in the 1990s.
And they've been trying to do something about it, but clearly it's too late. So obviously we know that they had their one-child policy. They abandoned that policy, and then they've gone to three children, and it doesn't seem to be abating the problem. Well, it can't be reversed.
This is one of the things that Musk tweeted about a while ago, is those stats on the replacement rate, which is 2.1 children per woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 2.1 children per woman to retain your population. But some of China's census stats leaked early this year.
Oh, so the real stats.
The real numbers. So these numbers were from, I think it was, I have it here, 2011 to 2020, the census. It showed that their replacement rate was 1.3.
Oh, so they're significantly
below. Okay, so 1.3 is not only bad, he says it's among the lowest of any people throughout human history.
Yeah, see, raise a fist, and I'll link to it in the show notes so you can see it for yourself. He did a great discussion about why China is a paper dragon. And of course, you and I have covered stories about China's technological advancements and what the CCP is doing and what their plans are. But the reality, fortunately, I mean, it's sad at the same time, but fortunately, it's going to stop them from being able to get a lot of their plans through. It seems like there's two problems in China. One is their massive decline in population, and two is their massive debt issues that seem to be accumulating at the moment. China is a paper dragon. It's all fake.
I tweeted one of the debt graphs of personal debt
in
China
seen
today.
That. Yeah.
They have, he has all the country's personal debt, and then he's got this line that's China. And
it's
it just
off
looks
the scale.
Like, it looks like Mount Everest compared to some molehills. It's just completely off the chart, and it looks insane. But some of these stats he's talking about, like China will soon have traveled from pre-industrial levels of wealth and health to post-industrial demographic collapse in a single human lifetime.
It's incredible.
So they're going to be back to where they started in the 1900s pretty soon.
Like, so lots of, poor people and farming. Like, yeah, that's all they'll be doing.
They're going to have complete demographic collapse. And he says this is certain to occur. Again, it's just the maths. In a single generation. That's all it's going to take.
Yeah, and that might sound like a positive thing when we talk about what their government is doing. But if China collapses, because we do live in a globalized society, that means that the rest of the world's in trouble too, well, right?
Yeah, here's the thing before you celebrate the collapse of the Communist Party. It's not going to be China dying alone, folks. It's Britain to Germany to Russia to Northwestern Europe to Japan to Korea to Canada and Spain. Much of the world's population faces mass retirements followed by population crashes at all the same time.
Mm.
This is what makes it global. It's not just one little area they're having this demographic problem, but somewhere else in the world it's okay. It's everywhere in the world has this demographic time bomb.
Well, I remember it used to be like that in the early 2000s. People were talking about Japan, and Japan had this aging population, and people were focusing, oh, well, Japan's moving more towards robotics so that they can use robotics to be able to help their elderly and service their workforce. And I remember the attitudes of people kind of being like, oh, well, that's Japan. Like, that's just Japan. Yeah, Japan's in trouble, but it's not here. But you're right. Well, he's right. It's everywhere.
Well, he said the point of no return was up to 30 years ago.
That recently?
20, 30 years ago.
So how could we
I mean, the point of no return wasn't like 2005.
How could we have changed that by increasing birth rates?
Having more kids. Just have to have more kids.
So then what happened, does he say, what happened 30 years ago where people just started having less kids?
Okay, I'll get to that in a moment. So he talks about the countries that have economies that ship out like raw commodities and import everything else. So some Middle Eastern countries are like this where they export oil, but literally everything else, like food and clothing and all the bits and pieces they need to run an advanced civilization, because the Middle East has high-tech cities, everything is imported.
Yeah, look at Dubai. I mean, it's a spectacular city, but everything's sand on the outside.
Yeah, they even import camels.
Really?
Yes, I read that today somewhere, that the Middle East has to import camels. They don't even have their own camels anymore. So some of these countries have advanced cities, for example, and they have all the technology that we have and like all the modernized stuff, but they don't have the things that got to those things.
So you mean like agriculture?
They don't have the foundation. Well, they got, they don't really have agriculture. They don't have a modernized state. They don't have like the right economic system, social progress, industrial development. So once they stop exporting that stuff, if anything breaks in that chain, they're screwed because they rely solely on the imports. It's like China relies solely on
heavy food imports
to keep going. Once that stops, it's basically famine, he says, on a biblical scale. Economic development, quality of life, longevity, health, and demographic expansion are all subject to the whims of globalization, or rather, in this case, deglobalization. So he has a great personal example here. So he lives at 75,000 feet in Colorado, and snow is obviously a seasonal occurrence. He says it's more like a way of life. And when he first moved to Colorado, he thought to himself, great, I've got this new home, I've got a new life, and it's a new me, and I'm going to get out there and get my body into it. And so he started hiking nearly every day. He got in shape. And when the snow came, he's like, I'm going to take care of this the old-fashioned way. And he got a shovel, and he was like, it's the dumbest thing he's ever done.
Why? Did he throw his back out?
Just trying to get rid of all that snow with just a shovel. Absolutely insane. A month later, he said he had a Toro gasoline-powered snowblower. He's just like, fuck off, snow, just blowing it away like it's a horde of zombies.
Such anger towards snow.
And before, it had been a 20-hour ordeal just to clear his driveway.
That's why we should be appreciative we live in this modern world.
Just to clear his driveway, it was like 20 hours. But now with this massive snowblower thing, it takes barely 2 hours.
You know what would fix the problem? A couple of kids.
Yeah, a couple of kids and snowblowers, like mini snowblowers. So the thing is, though, that 20 hours was just for his driveway, just his home. It's a 2-mile hoof, he says, from his driveway to the base of his mountain in Colorado, and another 7.5-mile canyon threading drive down to the Highland Plains, which hosts the city of Denver. That's a lot of shoveling. Without gasoline-powered snow clearing gear, he says, my house at 7,500 feet not only would have never been built, it couldn't be maintained.
Yeah.
It's like, again, this is an example of just one little example of how you need all those foundations of the society to maintain this guy's house on top of a mountain. Mm. Without all those layers of society, it never happened. The house doesn't exist. So Denver is on the eastern flank of the Rockies, and based on where it is with the higher altitudes and everything, there's hardly any rain. And when it does rain, it just evaporates really quickly. So Denver has figured out some ways to get around this lack of precipitation. There's a lot of lakes if you have an aerial view of this area. But they're not lakes, they're reservoirs. So they're basically capturing everything they can from the snow melt and from the precipitation. They're man-made reservoirs.
To store it.
To store the water. It's not nearly enough, though. Like, they need more. So the second action was to drill giant tunnels through the Rocky Mountains to connect to the state's western watersheds, where they can bring the water in from. At present, there's 24 of these transbasin diversion monsters, he calls them, like huge pipelines. They collectively store every drop and relocate some 25 billion gallons annually. And that's what enables Denver to exist. Without them, there's no city.
Because of simply access to this water supply.
And which all requires not only modern technology to build it, but it has to be maintained. Mm.
And I'm assuming pumps as well?
Yeah, he says, remove the technology required to maintain this whole system, and the maximum sustainable population for Denver and, you know, the surrounding areas is a tenth of what it is today. Oof. So instantly, 90% of your population is not viable if you can't maintain that water pipe anymore. Like, it's done.
And there's the issue at the moment because we're experiencing the reverse, like the El Nino, La Nina effect. I saw that I think it's a dam just outside of Las Vegas. It's at like one of the lowest levels it's ever been at. They're finding, you know, barrels with bodies in them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and boats that have sunk years ago. And it's actually, it's even lower than the intakes for the pipes that they use to feed or supply Las Vegas.
Well, the reason he mentions this story is because he says there's a version of this story in every single populated place in the world.
It's what does like, he mean?
Well, it might be an infrastructure issue somewhere, it might be a food security issue somewhere else, but there's always an element
it's a house of cards.
Civilization, well, it's an element that requires civilization for the population to exist.
Yes.
Right? And he says the bottom line is always the same, no matter what place you look at in the world. If for whatever reason global flows of products and services and energy and foodstuff are interrupted, the population and political and economic maps will completely change. So he says it doesn't, this deglobalization, it doesn't just mean the world gets darker and poorer. And like I was saying earlier, you're seeing that things are hard to get, things are slower, it's hard to find people to fill jobs. It's like everything's happening. It actually means something far, far worse than deglobalization. And he calls it the unraveling. So he says the world has two examples of what this unraveling will look like. And this is a good section to highlight. And I'm only just skimming this book. Remember, it's like 500 pages. Yeah. But I took this as a takeaway because it gives you a sense of what life will be like when this unravels. And by his calculations, 2022 is when it starts.
That's soon.
Yeah, he's like, it's right now. 2022, 2023 is when all this starts to unravel based on the maths of depopulation, when all the boomers start retiring. Like, it all is timed
but
on 2022, 2023.
What does COVID have to do with this? Because obviously COVID, not COVID itself, because not that many people died in scale, right? But obviously lockdowns would have affected significantly production. Is that what's kind of accelerating?
Yeah, he said it just moved up the timeline because the disruptions from COVID are never going to be fixed. Like, it's just basically started the meltdown. So he says later on that what we experienced with our prosperity in 2019, we're never going to have that again. Like, it's just downhill. There's no going back to 2019 levels of prosperity. And connect global,
but that was
connections.
From the sounds of it, that was going to happen anyway.
Yeah, we just pushed the timeline forward with COVID. So the examples of what life is going to be like is basically Zimbabwe and Venezuela.
Oh, no, you've got to be kidding me.
For Zimbabwe, it was
Zim dollars.
Food, and their export goods were food. For Venezuela, they exported oil. But massive mismanagement resulted in fund shortages so extreme, they couldn't import anything. And they just collapsed. In Zimbabwe, the result was more than a decade of negative economic growth and outcomes far worse than the Great Depression. And they basically just have subsistence farming. So they just farm for themselves. They don't export. Venezuela was worse. It imported more than 2/3 of its foodstuffs before its economic collapse. Venezuelan oil production dropped so much, the country even lacks sufficient fuel to sow crops. contributing to the worst famine in the history of the Western Hemisphere. So the word he says you're actually looking for to describe what's going to happen isn't deglobalization or deindustrialization. It's actually decivilize. Decivilize is the word.
It's truly terrifying.
And this American-led order that we had did more than just change the rules of the game. Like in the past, empires rose and fell in their separate little areas, right? And then their knowledge kind of fell with them. And then somewhere else would rise up. And the thing was, because of this golden age, or this mini golden age we're in, with this American-led order, it changed the rules of the game. And it allowed industrialization and urbanization to spread everywhere, all over the planet, all at once. So this, we had this guaranteed security, we had guaranteed supplies of capital and energy and food, and 6,000 years of what we'd seen in the past of ups and downs and empires rising and falling in different areas, that was thrown out the window for this unstoppable freight train of progress, which has given us the world we live in today. And everything's become so specialized.
Yes.
Like each country... It's imagine if the world is making a big machine, each country makes its own little part,
yep.
Right? Where everything's so hyper-specialized and we've become so advanced with specialization, we've become totally incompetent at tasks that used to be essential,
mm-hmm.
Right?
So we can't really fend for ourselves anymore.
Yeah, we can't. There's no way that you can be cut off from the world and maintain our level of civilization we have locally.
Well, that's the thing. Even I saw when we had the toilet paper crisis here in Australia, this is how dumb it is, right? We don't import toilet paper. Like toilet paper doesn't come into Australia. And yet we ran out.
Yeah.
Like it's all manufactured here. And that still wasn't enough.
Yeah. Like he points out this hyper-specialization is the norm now, but it's so complex. You've got entire economic subsectors like loan offices for areas and warehouse planning consultants and people that facilitate this and facilitate that, who don't actually create anything. They're just like in the mix, yeah, of this other sub-economy.
Yeah.
And now you've got countries that are specializing instead of just individuals. So like Taiwan specializes in semiconductors. Brazil specializes in soy. Kuwait specializes in oil. Germany
specializes... Well, the world really miss it if soy was wiped out, though. I mean...
I'm sure people would miss it. Germany specializes in machinery. And this whole like thrust of civilization has been reaching this ultimate optimal peak. But again, he just points out everything about this moment is artificial and it's failing. So is this sounding familiar? Let me know if what I'm about to read you sounds familiar. So countries looking down the maw of this demographic oblivion and globalizational collapse all share something in common. Reduced interaction, right? So what does that mean? It means we're not going to be trading with everyone else in the world. You're going to be more within your own borders. This means reduced access, which means reduced income, which means fewer economies of scale, which means less labor specialization, which means reduced interaction. Shortage forces people, forces countries to look after their own needs. The value-added advantage of continuity and labor specialization actually start to wither. Everyone becomes less efficient. Everyone becomes less productive. And that means, again, less of everything. Not just electronics, but electricity. Not just automobiles, but gasoline. Not just fertilizer, but food. The parts are less than the sum, he says, and it compounds. Again, this is like a snowball effect. Electricity shortages gut manufacturing. Food shortages gut the population. Fewer people means less chance of keeping anything that requires specialized labor working. Say things like road construction or the electrical grid or food production, it all stops. That is what decivilization means, a cascade of reinforcing breakdowns that do not simply damage, but destroy. The bedrock of what makes the modern world function is gone. Not every location had the right geography to make a go of civilization before the order. Not every location will be able to maintain civilization after order's end. He says, worst of all, many less advanced countries are wholly dependent upon civilization holding together in other places.
Mm.
He says Zimbabwe and Venezuela, like they're examples of choosing their own destiny. Like they chose communism.
We all know how that was going to turn out.
They voted in, their communist dictators and, they paid for it. But after this deglobalization,
it's involuntary.
It'll be thrust on everyone,
yeah.
Right? It'll be those conditions. So this whole thing was never going to last, he said. What you and your parents assumed as the normal, good and right way of living, like the past seven decades, it's a historic anomaly in human history. That period again, 1980 to 2015, has been a unique, isolated, blessed moment in time, and the moment has ended. A moment that will certainly not come again in our lifetimes, and that isn't even the bad news.
So and what's the bad news?
This is like 10% in, and I'm just like, oh God, why did I read? Oh, I should have just done that book about the yogi that hypnotized an elephant and rode into the Himalayas and then floated off to see the aliens. Like that would have been
much better, yes.
A much easier story to do.
Less depressing at least, hopefully.
So he starts talking about like, what system is going to persist in the future in this post-2022 world? And he talks about capitalism and socialism and fascism and communism. And he's like, none of those are really going to be around. If people try them, they won't work.
What will work?
He says imperialism is coming back in a big way.
Yeah.
He says the only thing that might have a chance of working is imperialism. And basically some country with power using other regions as slaves, basically. So slavery is coming back, like I mentioned earlier.
But not only imperialism, it's probably going to be feudalism as well.
Even then he like stops himself and he says, look, the only way that you would have imperialism is having a military capable of projecting that massive power onto locations that can't resist.
And subjugating them?
But also subjugating them. Like that's how imperialism would work is you basically, it's like the British in India.
Like they
didn't need many soldiers. I think they had one British soldier to 4,000 Indians, but they had superior technology. You know, they had superior weapons so they could subjugate the population. You would maybe see the same thing with that in the future, but he says what you would need is lots and lots and lots of disposable young people. And he says,
he
basically stops himself and says, the last country that had that was the US after World War II. And now that's done because of the demographic issues I was explaining earlier. There's no countries that could actually project imperialism in the future. So
that's not going to happen either.
Yeah.
Then.
Everything's going to change. He says the process will be the definition of traumatic. It's really nothing kind of positive in this. So he says the globalization game is not simply ending. It's already over. Most countries will never return to the degree of stability or growth they experienced in 2019. And now most have lost the chance to even try to shift onto a newer, more appropriate footing.
Did you really have to do this?
Okay, so I know this is depressing, and he actually writes in his book, he's like, all right, take a break after this chapter, go get a cup of tea and then come back maybe a day later, maybe sleep on it because I know this is rough. And towards the end, he's like, look, I'm really sorry. I know the information's bad. Don't shoot the messenger. Like, I apologize. I'm sorry the news is bad.
Is he just a cynic? Like, I know that he's obviously, I mean, it doesn't matter really about what your qualifications are. If you've got a certain agenda, you know, if you're a cynic, is that what's going on here?
No, because he says it's math.
Mm.
Especially when you go deep into the chapters on the amount of people you need to input into the economy,
mm-hmm.
those people just aren't there.
So is it because people are just simply aging out?
Yeah.
That's all it is.
And I have a little bit on that later in more detail, but I wanted to give you just a bright spark of a solution because there is a solution.
Good.
There is a way out of this. It's still painful, but there is a solution. Be American. I don't like that answer either. Because that's obviously not me.
Have you seen what's going on in America at the moment?
No, I mean, I know.
Energy systems are being strangled.
Look, I said it was still going to be painful. But bottom line, in a world without more, which is what the new world will be, because previously everything was about more. This is faster. This is better. This is improving. This is great. This is great. That's done. It's a future world without more. The United States, he says, not only still has plenty, but it actually has the capacity to keep it. But even better than that, he says, to this point, the Americans largely have managed to escape much of the global development and demographic trap. So this is the solution to be American. He basically describes how America will be insulated from this in a way. He goes back to the baby boomers, and this will answer your question on how this actually happens with the demographics. So okay. You have this baby boom. Between the war's end and 1965, you got 70 million births occurred in a country that before the war had under 135 million souls.
That was our parents. Our parents are baby boomers.
But he's talking about the US. This is specifically America. And he says, look, the horror of the baby boomers was unleashed upon us all. But the rest of the world, like here in Australia too, we had the baby boomer generation.
Yeah.
Everywhere had the baby boomer generation. But the American boomers were much, much more populous.
Oh.
There's much, much more of them.
Right.
And today, the boomers are in their twilight, as we know.
Mm-hmm.
So as we enter the 2020s, they're like a spent demographic force. They're basically in their twilight. Calendar years 2022 and 2023, and this is why he's saying these years are like the trigger point. This is when the majority of the boomers will have turned 65 and shift into retirement.
Who's going to greet people at Walmart?
No one. This generates a double hit to labor markets. He says the baby boomers are the largest ever generation, so their absence is a huge impact in numerical terms. They are also the oldest economically active generation, meaning that their numbers comprise the bulk of all available skilled labor.
Yeah, right.
Remove so many high-skilled workers in a short period of time, and labor shortages and labor inflation are a foregone conclusion for years to come. So Generation X, obviously they were a bit smaller. They were never going to fill this gap that was left by the boomers. They've got a lower labor rate participation as well. So that's going to result in an even larger labor shortage. And at the bottom of the scale, you've got the zoomers. Now, the zoomers are pretty eager workers, but there's not that many of them because they came from a smaller prior generation.
What age category are zoomers?
Zoomers are like...
like the 2010s?
After millennials.
Right, okay.
They're the children of Gen X.
Mm-hmm.
A small generation generates a small generation. So yeah, Gen X was a pretty small generation. Then there's even smaller with the Zoomers. Even if they all follow in the footsteps of the baby boomers and they all enter the workforce, there's just nowhere near enough of them to round out the labor force for the next two decades. Again, this is just simple maths. This is why I haven't seen much criticism of his data, because anyone can just do the calculations on the back of an envelope. And he includes all the graphs of aging populations and everything. So this is the same all over the world, except for one major difference. And this is why the solution to this problem is be American. America's boomers did something that nobody else did. Well, not to the degree the American boomers did.
Not even here.
Not even here.
Oh, we're screwed.
They had kids. The American boomers had heaps of kids.
Yeah, they did.
Tons of them. So America's millennial generation has something going for them that no other millennial cadre does globally. They exist. The American millennials are already the largest demographic in the workforce by number. And he says, that's great. That's essential. But the real hope is their children. The American millennials' numbers raise the possibility that they will have enough children to someday fill the labor gap. But the soonest that will happen is, I think, mid-2040s. And there's the caveat here. Those millennials must first have those children that are going to fill that workforce gap in 2040. And at present, the birth rate for millennials is the lowest in American history.
Oh, wow. Yep.
So here's the thing. Millennials can save America.
God help us all.
You can save your civilization, but you have to start having kids right now. Well, but right now, but yesterday.
Whatever has happened in this particular generation, I mean, it's happening globally, right? There's this infantile, it's like this term adulting came about. It's like, no, you are an adult. Like, it seems to be like this infantile attitude that this generation has, that they're not having kids. They're delaying putting it off. They're focusing on their careers. One of the biggest ones that I just find to be the most stupid thing of, I'm not having children because I'm saving the environment. Having kids is the best thing you can do. Honestly, it's the best thing you can ever do.
I mean, for yourself and for civilization as well. And he doesn't look too much at the sociological reasons, at the cultural reasons. He just looks at the broader picture and the maths of it all, the economic realities of
it. Sure, yeah.
And when you look beyond the United States, it's just screwed because most of the world's boomers in other countries didn't have the same amount of kids that they had in America.
So it's not even like a Western thing. It was just America.
No, it's just America.
Wow.
And obviously there's cultural reasons for that as well, but he doesn't go into them. He's just looking at the reality of the stats. East Asia, for example, is densely populated already. So, you know, like Japan, they don't have much room.
Aging population.
Most of Europe spent its money on technical upgrades rather than making it easier to raise families. Canada is so cold, everyone flocked to cities to stay warm and you can't really have a big family in an apartment. So, overall, it was just like this situation where America still has a way out purely based on population demographics. But American boomers, when they all retire, which again is this year and next year, it's going to break the bank, he says. But it's nothing compared to what's going to happen in China, Korea, Japan, Thailand, Brazil, Germany, Italy, Poland, Russia, and Iran. They're all doubly screwed, including us, because we just don't have the follow-on generation to fill the gap that the retirement of the boomers creates. It's really screwed. He says, for the rest of the world, it will never get better than it was in the 2010s. Never. Pretty bold claim.
Very bold claim.
The math is pretty simple, he says. Now, again, he goes back to China. Like, he starts talking about hegemonies and who's going to emerge as, you know, after all this in the 2040s and 2050s as the superpower. And the thing is like, it's not going to be China, because he goes through all this data on why China is just more screwed than anyone on the planet.
Well, Evergrande, anyone?
It's going to be America again.
Wow.
Not only will America be basically the post-apocalyptic superpower, they will be even more powerful than before because the rest of the world will be so screwed.
Well, as long as they keep up their principles, you know, which is under attack, you know, but the First Amendment, freedom of speech, you know, the ideas and the principles of freedom, as long as they keep that up, well, then ultimately, eventually, the world should be right.
Yeah, he says their share of global population will increase. So, you know, China's got the biggest population right now.
Not for
long. It's going to be America. By like 2050, it's going to be America.
But does that suggest that America could have a populace that could be, you know, 500 million? Now, what have they got at the moment? About 400 million. So what, could they go into the billions?
It just means they have a greater percentage.
Okay.
So that's likely means the rest of the world is going to have massive population declines from people dying and just not having babies. And he says when he wrote this book, like he's 48 now, you know, the 2050s is a while away. He's probably not going to be around. But all of that is really just the setup for what he delivers, which is, I mean, the true purpose of what he's written here is to lay out what the transition looks like, what the world we're all going to live through is going to feel like. So he says, let's talk about life after the end of the world. Now, he starts to break this down into sections. So he's got transport, finance, energy, industrial materials, manufacturing, and the last one's agriculture. And he starts going into kimchi quesadillas. And he's like, I love kimchi quesadillas.
It's like a fusion food.
Well, he just makes the point that you go to any grocery store today and it really is incredible. Like if you want Himalayan salt with cholesterol-free eggs and sushi-grade tuna with hothouse cucumbers from God knows where and wasabi mayo and nori sheets and all this elaborate stuff, it's there. It's not only there, it's pretty cheap and you can get it all the time.
Yeah.
He says this is an incredible invention that you'll probably never, ever see again, like in thousands of years. It's simply availability and low cost, but it's reliable availability and reliable low cost. Now, he says, take that concept of this utter availability and apply it to absolutely everything, right? And that's a glimmer, he says, of the absolute connectivity that underpins the modern globalized world economy. The ingredients of today's industrial and consumer goods are only available because they can be moved from literally halfway around the world at low costs and high speeds and in perfect security.
Well, only recently I was reading something about the cost of shipping containers. So to move a shipping container, you know, 10 years ago was dirt cheap.
Yeah.
But now those shipping containers are skyrocketing.
Yeah, he points out phones, fertilizers, oil, cherries, single malt whiskey, whatever you can think of. It's all in motion all the time. And transportation is the ultimate enabler of this global civilization that we have. So he starts going into the transport technologies. And like you were just mentioning, he spends a lot of time on shipping. And he tells this quick war story during the Iran-Iraq war back in the 1980s. And it was a stalemate by 1983. So either side was basically taking pops at each other's shipping sectors instead of firing at each other, like they were just trying to take out industrial targets. So some 300 shipping vessels were struck, 50 were disabled, and a dozen were sunk. So it's not a, I mean, in terms of global shipping, like a dozen sunk vessels.
Doesn't sound like a lot.
It's nothing, right? But that nearly destroyed the global insurance sector. Like it nearly destroyed the economy.
How?
So, okay. So if you look at the entire history of this order of America, protecting shipping, protecting trade, America World Police, creating this amazing environment where everyone can trade without worrying about pirates and bloody opposing nations blowing up their ships. That's just made shipping incredibly safe. And because of that, there's no like underwriting and insurance for it. Like you're not, it would be like putting away millions of dollars for an earthquake here in Coolum.
Yeah, because we're never going to have an earthquake.
Australia. Well,
it's highly unlikely.
It's just, it's pointless. So these insurance companies didn't really have provisions for for coming in on these claims. They didn't have the capital for it. So they then filed claims with their reinsurance firms, and then those firms started to run dry as well.
Effect.
They ran out of capital as well. Suddenly all insurance companies discover that their entire industry is teetering on the precipice. Fire insurance, car insurance, mortgage insurance, health insurance. It didn't matter what it was. They were basically screwed. They had no capital. They were done. And because insurance firms are linked to bond markets and large financial corporations, like it was going to be the end of the world. The only thing that stopped global financial breakdown because a couple of ships got sunk in the Middle East is Reagan started physically escorting non-Iranian shipping into the Persian Gulf. They designated all ships as American vessels so that they wouldn't fire on them. And they gave them like sovereign indemnity for their shipping. So again, it was like America acting as world police that avoided global catastrophe. But he goes into, imagine if that event happened today, because there hasn't been American ships in that region regularly for a very long time. And once this American order stops protecting all this shipping and all this trade for everyone, once America stops being world police, all of these shipping vessels are vulnerable to other states, to pirates, to a rogue country firing on them. And once global shipping becomes unsafe, you stop that, you don't have that infrastructure for things to be moving around all the time.
Freely and rapidly.
For this interconnected global society. And once that stops, it's all over.
It's an accelerating cascade.
It's done. Like, yeah, it's this cascading failure. Because think about the stuff that you have and use in your everyday life. How much of it is made in your country?
None of it.
None of it. Like, I can look around this room.
I'm doing that right now. Like, none of it's made here.
Not a single thing that's made in
here. Chinese-made laptops, German-made audio equipment. Actually, no, I'm wrong. The shipping container. The recording studio was made here, but all the materials.
The shipping container wouldn't have been made here. This would have been made in China.
Yeah, I guess so.
All the materials would have been imported from overseas as well.
The timber's
all
Australian.
All the foam. Yeah, the timber.
And that's it.
Maybe this plastic bottle was made in an Australian plant.
No, it was probably made in China.
But is it? Can't see.
Most of it is, though.
Just says recycle on it. But that's the thing. Like, once all that stuff stops coming, and this goes back to the car thing of, like, he quotes this famous saying, like, you need 30,000 pieces to make a car. If you've only got 29,999, you've got a heavy paperweight that's pretty much useless. And that's the same with many things. That's why we're seeing so many delays on things, why things are slowly starting to not work because this shipping is breaking down. We've seen because of COVID, these ports are just getting backed up with all these ships. This is what's causing it now.
Have you seen those tweets showing China's, because when they shut down Shanghai, they shut down their ports. You see all the ships that were just sitting waiting and then you see it on like a map and it was just chockers, like completely full of all these ships waiting. And the problem is the longer that they wait, they can't get into port, which causes further cascade problems further on, and then it disrupts the entire supply chain.
Yeah, he says the web is failing. Just past the horizon looms a world of lower and less reliable agricultural yields, marred by less variety, a world with less energy or fewer manufactured goods. Is the difference between wealth and security or poverty and conflict?
Well, it's already happening here in Australia. Only last night, the Australian government issued a warning saying that we should be very careful with the use of our power because there was going to be rolling blackouts across New South Wales and Queensland. We are in a very energy-rich country. There is no reason as to why Australia should be experiencing rolling blackouts. But that's where we're going to end up. Because what will happen is power infrastructure will start going down. So you're thinking, oh, it's okay, I'll just get to spend more time at home and I can watch more Netflix and I can, like, we're done. Like, Mysterious Universe, everything. Anything that's computer-based, internet-based, it's done.
Well, I was trying to think of something that would remain from the old world. And this is kind of the point of what he's saying is that there will be nothing left from the old world.
No.
We really will be living in ruins of the previous civilization. And his argument is that's basically already started to happen.
I pray he's wrong. Like, I pray that he has overestimated this, that he's forgotten to carry the one. And I also really hope that humanity somehow, as we always seem to, sidesteps disaster. I don't know how. I don't have the answers, but I just really hope that this is not our future.
Again, with the demographic calculations, it's unavoidable. And I can't see where he's wrong. I can't see where you have all these. Because again, think about the boomers all retiring. You've got all these people leaving and they're skilled people. It's like you no longer have the people with the skills to run the incredibly complex society. Once those people are gone and there's no one else to fill the position, things stop working.
Could our advancement, though, could he be forgetting to factor in, you know, our advancement in technology and automation? Could automation be actually clearing up more of those jobs so we don't need as many people to run this kind of stuff? Is that a possibility?
Well, we've just been trying to automate a ton of things behind the scene with our business. And
it's gotten worse.
Do you need more people to do that or do you need less people to do that?
At the moment for us, it feels like you need more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You need people to control it, to design it. You need the know-how to maintain it. So the argument is there's just not going to be people to maintain the civilization. And on the topic of these the shipping, he's like, transportation is the connective tissue that holds the world together.
And logistics.
Like, he starts drawing up all the new Europes and countries that will exist.
Oh.
Because everything will basically split. And he talks about how Japan has a great navy, but they don't have any food to feed everyone. So they're going to have to start expanding out and trying to seek their own food.
Into where?
Well,
China?
Wherever they can, whoever they can trade with, but they won't have the protection of America's Navy necessarily. So he talks about, one thing he does say about Australia is that we'll be okay with food.
Great, yeah. I mean, we've got heaps of farming land and although a lot of it's owned by China. But yeah, we should be okay.
We can sustain ourselves okay with food, and we'll probably make alliances with New Zealand and the rest of Southeast Asia. But he said the biggest criticism...
New Zealand, do we have to?
The biggest criticism against our situation is we don't have the military to protect the trade routes.
No, we don't. We've got a very small military, yeah. But could we, here I'm thinking, well, could we just build a bigger military, but then you'd have to build more warships, so then you would need the materials to build those warships, and okay.
So it's really interesting stuff, and I wanted to mention this and talk about it a little bit, just to really send it in your direction, because I think it's really good to be prepared and see what's on the horizon, and you can prepare. Like, one example is you've got to get out of the cities, because he says the cities are done. Because modern cities require the hyper-connected, hyper-specialized, globalized world and all those goods coming in and out constantly to stay functioning.
Mm.
Once that stops, cities basically break down and they cease to exist. They don't work anymore. So he says people will be forced to flee to the countryside in massive numbers. So if you want to get ahead of the game, you might want to do that sooner rather than later.
Well, that's the thing. There's no infrastructure to support large numbers of people moving out there at the moment. So yeah, if you want to get prepared, that's the way to go.
So get out of the cities. Start making plans to be more self-sufficient.
Although we've been hearing phrases like that for a while, really, since, riding took off, in America. That was one thing you saw on social media all the time, was people saying, get out of the cities. Like, they're getting worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, it was good advice then too.
It was, yeah.
Still good advice. So he's got a bunch of ideas in there. And again, it's a huge, incredibly researched work. The End of the World is Just the Beginning, Mapping the Collapse of Globalization by Peter Zeihan. I'll link to it in the show notes. Hope that wasn't too
Thanks so
depressing.
Much, Ben. That's like really positive. I just choose to believe. I don't care if I'm looking at the world through rose-colored glasses. I'm just going to believe that humanity will always find a way. We seem to. We have avoided, massive catastrophes before. We've managed to get through. And yes, our society has fundamentally been changed. So we're talking about the Bronze Age collapse, for example, and the fall of Rome. But somehow we come back.
Bronze Age collapse, he mentions them. Fall of Rome, he mentions it. It's nothing compared to today, because the Bronze Age collapse was a hyper-connected series of city-states.
Yes.
In Europe.
Yeah.
In the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
It wasn't the entire globe. The entire world. So,
but surely, Ben, surely, okay, let me just ask this question. Surely people would have seen this coming. Like, wouldn't there be people studying demographics that would have gone, hang on, we've got a problem here. We've got an aging population. Why is it that there aren't government campaigns to say, have more children? Like, why? And every single nation seems to have done that. Why are we still sitting in this weird narrative of we're overpopulated? When the next thing that's happening, according to this, is we're going to collapse.
I think that's more of a cultural question, because I think some people really want to collapse.
They do.
Because they have this idea that they'll rebuild the world the way they see it. They'll rebuild a new utopia. And that's a completely different thing.
Yeah.
And you can even argue that there seems to be some attempt to accelerate this decline.
I think so, yeah.
Certain ideologies, certain factions within society are trying to accelerate this decline.
Yeah.
I mean, you keep mentioning to me all these food processing plants in the States that are going up in flames. And I said to you when you first mentioned, I was like, oh, that's like 0.1% of America's food processing plants. Like, so what if five of them go up in flames?
It's not five.
Freaking thousands of them.
The last time I checked, it was like 49 of them, I think, that have small planes hitting them and unexplained fires. And I'm like, oh, that's just a weird coincidence.
That is a weird one, where at first I was like, okay, this is just whatever. You're going to have a bunch of fires in these places all the time. But I don't know. It's starting to look like a pattern.
Because what's going to happen if America is plunged into starvation? Whoever wants to do that can control the population, because you control the food supply. Bam, problem solved. Well, for them at least. It's a very, very dark. I mean, I know it sounds very conspiratorial, but I must say a lot of conspiracy theorists have been correct recently. So, it doesn't look good. It does. And it's very, very odd. And what happens if the food supply collapses? Who knows if America's being attacked internally?
Again, go back to the population issue. Purely look at that.
Yeah.
If you have doubts about this, look into depopulation and just ask yourself, who's going to be doing things that run this civilization when the boomers retire And the generation that follows is much, much smaller. And that generation isn't having kids.
Yeah.
And then that generation after isn't having kids either. What's actually going to happen?
And
it's inevitable that it collapses. It isn't some kind of, oh, maybe it will, maybe it won't, maybe we'll keep going. It cannot function without the human beings to run it.
Yeah.
It's really that simple. And that's why people like Musk have it pinned right there on his timeline.
It's probably why he wants to go to Mars, wants to get away, but it'll be better there than it is here.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's insane. Going to Mars. Like, even if you go to Mars, it's still
it's being facetious.
A million
like,
times worse.
You've got to try and build, exactly. But what I'm saying is that like...
You'd rather be in Venezuela than on Mars, probably. Like, honestly. Like, at least in Venezuela, you can eat a rat. If there's still some left. Like, in Mars, you can't even eat a rat.
But that's actually what happened, right? When this has happened previously, when there's been the collapse of civilization... Particularly, I know we keep on coming back to this, but when communism takes over, people eat circus and zoo animals.
They eat everything.
That's what happens.
That's why in North Korea, there's no trees and there's no bugs and there's no animals because people just ate them all.
Yep. Yep. And that's where we potentially could be heading. And think about it. Like, just for a moment, like, let's not try and get too upset about it. But let's say the supply chain collapses tomorrow and you can't go to the supermarket. Like, everyone's rushed to the supermarket. There's no food. What are you going to do?
I'm thinking,
is this the Alex Jones, I'm going to eat my neighbor's stuff? Is that where we're at?
You'll be dead in a week. Seriously, like everyone will die in a week. And I said to you, like, if you're going to hunt, what are you going to hunt? And you said kangaroos. There's plenty of kangaroos. Well, there won't be plenty of kangaroos in about 2 weeks
because
everyone else will be eating the kangaroos. Yeah. There'll be no kangaroos left. So there'll be no animals left.
So if you're that willing to survive, you're eating people.
Yeah.
That's where we're at.
Cannibalism.
Nice way to end the show.
I think that's a perfect spot to end the show. Aaron, thanks. I'll link to The End of the World is Just the Beginning, Mapping the Collapse of Globalization by Peter Zeihan. You can find a bunch of YouTube videos with him as well. Excellent researcher. Coming up in our Plus extension.
Something far more positive.
Lighten it up a bit.
A little bit lighter, far more positive. We're going to go into psi phenomena. We're going to go into vortigers. We're going to go into invading past life entities, all that great kind of stuff. It's all coming up on the Plus extension. And don't worry, no one's going to die. Well, some people do.
Isn't it near-death experiences? Isn't that the whole point?
But it's all warm and fuzzy. It's all positive in the end.
Sign up for Plus to get access to that. Head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus for all the details. Help support your favorite show. It's only $9 a month. You get access to the big extensions we do on these shows every single Friday, and you get an exclusive show every single Tuesday as well, along with a higher quality audio version of our show, a totally ad-free version of the show. And you also get access to our entire back catalogue if you upgrade to MU Max as well. Again, check out all the details at mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Thanks for listening. Sorry to be the deliverer of bad news. I'm sure everything will be fine. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. Plus extension. Great to have you.